Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasha. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on VBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by the Rockstar Chronicles Series 1, my new book featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know. Available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. Joe Louis Walker picked up the guitar as a child, and by the time he was 16, was an in-demand musician on the local club scene, regularly backing touring blues artists rolling through town. As a 16-year-old, he was the house guitarist at San Francisco's famed musical playground, The Matrix, where he played with or opened shows for everyone from Lightnin' Hopkins to Jimi Hendrix to Thelonious Monk. In addition to his work at The Matrix, he was a regular at Bill Graham's famed Fillmore West. San Francisco's music scene was quickly becoming a melting pot of blues, jazz, and psychedelic rock, and Walker was right in the center of it. These ear-opening surroundings explain the ease with which Walker blends blues, rock, gospel, jazz, and country, making it seem as if the walls between the genres never existed in the first place. Blues legend Walker accompanied shared not only musical knowledge, but also their personal wisdom with the teenage up-and-comer. Fred McDowell, Ike Turner, Albert King, Freddie King, Robert Jr. Lockwood, Lightnin' Hopkins, and many others taught, fed, and chastised the youngster, whose icon Willie Dixon told him to set his sights high. What's your style? You need your own sound, Dixon preached. Walker took the advice to heart and developed his own fiery, melodic, and always unpredictable guitar attack. Walker met legendary guitarist Michael Bloomfield in 1968, and the two became fast friends. Bloomfield introduced Walker to many of the day's top rockers, including Sly Stone, Carlos Santana, Steve Miller, Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead, Jarmo Kekkonen, who we just had on the show, and even jazz legend Wayne Shorter. Bloomfield helped push Walker's blues in a more rock-fueled direction, and he became the single biggest influence on the young Walker's sound. The two shared an apartment for years and remained close friends until Bloomfield's death in 1981. Walker has released 24 albums and toured the world virtually nonstop. He has garnered 4 Blues Music Awards and holds an international reputation as one of the blues' most prolific and talented stars. He's also recorded as a guest with some of the blues world's best-known artists, including appearances on Grammy-winning records by B.B. King and James Cotton. His latest release is entitled Blues Coming On, joined by a host of talented friends and peers on this superb studio album. Features guest performances by fellow blues icons Keb Moe, Eric Gales, and Albert Lee, plus Detroit soul singer, friend of the show, Mitch Ryder, punk rock vocalist Charlie Harper, legendary session player Waddy Wachtel, and many others. The album explodes with the passionate playing and soulful melodies that have made Walker a favorite among true blues aficionados, including the Rolling Stones. It's available now at Amazon.com. Please welcome legendary blues guitarist, singer, songwriter, producer, Joe Louis Walker to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Joe.
Hey, well, thank you, man.
Was that about sum it up?
Well, yeah, you know, it, I I'm used to, you know, things getting jumbled around a little bit. So, really, you know, just little things like, you know, I opened up for the Thelonious Monk and I got to talk to him, but that was at the Carousel Ballroom, which was called the Fillmore West.
Right.
I met Jimmy in this through Buddy Miles, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I was at parties with Michael, you know, when Jimmy was there. And Sly Stone was in the same neighborhood I'm from.
Really?
Riverside neighborhood in San Francisco. So I met Sly maybe 8 years before I even met Michael. You know, and in fact, I was there when Michael met Sly. So, okay, it was better.
Really?
But it's all good because we were all, you know, I was the young guy, always mm-hmm. pretty much the youngest guy in the room. You know, so it was just all good because, you know, but like with Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock, that was much later when I became a member of the Thelonious Monk Institute when I moved to the East Coast. And, well, on the West Coast, I was living out there too, and there, it's about when I became a part of that, then I would do, we always do the National Day of Jazz, and I would do the Blues Guys. Sometimes it would be me, sometimes it would be Robert Gray, sometimes it would be Jeff Moore. The Big Show was the one with BB and all of us together, Wayne, Vino, Ed, blah, 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 blah. So it's all one big gumbo.
I like that, one big gumbo. did your parents name you after the famous fighter Joe Louis?
Actually, my name is Louis Joseph Walker II.
Okay.
What happened was my older sister, rest her soul, when I was a kid,
we lived
out in the country in Fresno and Madera, California. That we called Central Valley. Well, you know, we pick games and what have you. And my sister used to have to watch me because I was always a precocious little boy. And what she did was that Joe Louis was the number one African American icon.
Right.
At the time, my sister just flipped my name around. You know, Joe Louis. My dad wasn't crazy about it.
Here's a little story about Joe Louis. My mom worked for the Blue Cross in the Red Cross, I'm sorry, in New York when she was like a teenager or she was in her early 20s or something like that. And she was on the subway with my aunt. And Joe Louis was on the train with his military uniform because he was in the service. And he gave his seat to my mom and my aunt. He stood up and gave them. She'll never forget that. Is you know, it was.
You got to travel far and wide to find a bad story about Joe.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, he was just a class act. You know.
Yeah, he was. He was a really good guy. Very. He was a big favorite among everybody. I guess.
Yeah.
I think it's cool how you started so young. And met all these incredible legends, and you know that you learned from them. And you said a couple of things funny. You were the guy that they since you were so young, you're the guy that went out and got the coffee, the barbecue,
cigarettes. cigarettes, you know, and I was a guy later on that would, you know, go out and get other things, you know. especially when Muddy's band came to town, you know. It's like, Joe, you know the few girls you were with last
time? Oh, my God.
You want to come to the show?
Oh, man.
Yeah, I think they'd have to come to the show. I mean, but that was a different time. It was all a good fun.
Well, you got some stories, man. Have you written a book?
I'm sorry?
Have you written a book? You need to write a book.
Well, I'm thinking about it. You know, every time I get ready to do it, something really, really crazy happens in my life. Just say, you know what? I was going to start writing a book when I was 50.
Right.
And I thought I'd seen a lot then, you know, and then I just happened. And I've learned I wanted 60. And now, you know, how did you write a book and not put the pandemic in it? So,
yes.
if I live through this year, I think, you know, and that's serious. I mean, you never know. You know, I will definitely start putting something down, you know.
Well, if you need any help, I'm an author. I've got a new book out and I've done several books. You know, if you need any help anyway, just give me a ring.
I like you read that book you were talking about, yep. The Yankees and stuff.
Yeah, I've got, I interviewed Johnny Winter. He was telling me that muddy water's like champagne. I was thinking, you know, you always think blues guys like whiskey, you know, and that kind of thing, but he said he liked champagne.
No, muddy was adamant. I'll never forget when I spent time with muddy. He was adamant, and you know, it just shows you how older guys were really, really smart. He just said, hard liquor makes you evil. You know, he said, and he's right. Think about it for a minute. He said, you know, if you're thinking something bad, hard liquor just makes you think worse. You know, and so that's why he wrote that song, Champagne and Liquor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that was, you know, it really just shows what kind of guy he was, that he could put the brakes on himself with something like that, because I'll tell you, 9 times out of 10 guys, it's really hard to put a brakes on yourself, you know, when you got people coming to you all the time, offering you this, offering you that, offering you that, offering you this.
Right.
You know, so I always respected Muddy Waters to that one in particular.
Oh, I love Muddy Waters, you know, and you know, there wouldn't be any music at all if it wasn't for the blues. I mean, to me, the blues started everything, you know. And, you know, we should have cherished the blues a lot more than we have, especially in this country, because we created it, you know, basically.
Yeah, well, you know, our country is... Yeah, right now, you know, everything, it's like a gumbo. It really is. And it's like if you don't put one ingredient in it, or a fine stew or
right.
a fine stick on the food, you think. Mm-hmm. Anything like that, my favorite, Dolly Parton, Coat of Many Colors.
Uh-huh.
Coat of Many Colors. And if you take one strand out of that coat of those many colors, it falls apart.
Right, right.
Well, with the blues, it's been the foundation of the Coat of Many Colors, but it never really gets the serious due unless it's packaged in a way that America likes its heroes.
Right, right.
And America likes its heroes, mm-hmm. It's reflected in a mirror. And so when you get past all that, then you can see, you know, that it's going to be the way it is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's what I respect about guys like Muddy and BB and them.
Right.
They could not play the hand mm-hmm. that they wanted to be dealt.
Right.
They had to play the hand they were dealt.
Yep.
You know, and that's what makes, to me, the whole situation of the blues, which is not a bunch of notes
mm-hmm.
coming off a guitar. It is not $1 million tour bus. It is not $500,000 seats in an Armani suit.
Right.
With an English accent.
Right.
The blues comes out of some serious, serious pain.
Mm-hmm.
And you can play the notes, but once you have lived what those notes come out of, then you have a real credibility that comes with the blues.
Right.
Blues means credibility and authenticity.
Sure.
That's what it means.
Exactly.
In a nutshell. And you don't have to be a different guy or the other, but what you do have to be, you have to be connected to what it is, that essence.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I'm not going to start singing about a little red rooster that I ain't never seen. Now, I have seen a little red rooster, but I'm not going to start singing it. You know, because that's not who I am. I'm going to be thinking about what happened to me
right.
in certain situations. And every blues guy that I knew, like Willie Dixon or whoever it was, B.B. King, Joe, don't try to be me.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to sing about, you know, you can do a homage to somebody.
Right.
But I'm not going to hang my hat on doing a tour of three kings. I'm not going to do a tour playing the music of B.B., Freddie, and Albert. I'm not going to do it.
Right.
God bless somebody else if they can do it and make $1 trillion doing it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's like wearing somebody else's shoes. I don't want to do that.
Sure.
I'm not going to make a career playing note for note like Albert King. I'm not going to do it.
Yep.
I knew Albert King. The first thing he said was, son, good by yourself. What you playing in seven notes? I know fuck. That's the first thing he's gonna tell me. You know, and so I can, you know, so you talk about why the blues, you know, sort of get, you know, pushed to the back sometimes. Well, it does in some people's case, and some people's case it doesn't. That's just being honest.
Well, jazz too, you know, jazz was so important,
right,
you know, in our culture, and now it's almost non-existent, you know. I mean, you had to really find, you know, especially new artists today. It's hard to find any new jazz. It really is.
Well, it's weird, you know, because every time I go overseas, and I've been going overseas for 30, 40 years.
Right.
You know, and people would always say, well, why do you guys treat it so good overseas? Why do you treat it? Because they do treasure culture.
They do.
You know, the culture that it comes out of.
I agree with you.
They're not so blown over by the hype sometimes, you know, and that's why you had all the English guys coming back over here doing blues, you know, with their energy, with it, because it spoke to their heart and their soul.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you'll probably keep wishing, you know what I'm saying? He didn't want to be a Frank Sinatra. No disrespect to Frank Sinatra.
Right.
He wanted to be Scotty Moore.
Sure.
You wanted to be a Muddy Waters. You didn't want it. That's not what reached them. Because that authentic, you know, you can relate to what, you know, to some of the stuff that Muddy, well, all the stuff Muddy said, the Wolf, whatever, what have you. So it is, you know, and you got another little generation coming out now that the blues is just so varied, which for me, that's cool. You know, it's so varied. I think it's a big thing.
Yeah, I was talking to Shirley. Shirley was on the other day. Shirley King.
Yeah,
she's cool, and she did, you know, mention that, you know, BB made the blues fun. You know, he didn't make it dark and dreary and this and that. You know, he was on Sesame Street. You know, he was on different TV shows, and he made the blues fun and where people can, you know, really, you know, understand it. You know, and Shirley's doing the same thing. She's like a comic. She's really funny. So, it's a different interpretation, you know.
Well, you know, the Black Sunhouse said, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's, to show you, you know, how the blues is, there's Robert Johnson.
Yep.
There's a lot of people, they just get Robert Johnson on the brain. Oh, Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
Robert Johnson. The devil's so short. And then you have Sunhouse.
Yep.
Somehow that sounds like death metal. You got the real stuff that was happening down south when he was down there.
Right.
Where Robert Johnson got My Baby's Red Hat.
Right.
And, you know, and Crossroads. All these things that people can say, well, we don't want to look at that real dark shit that went on.
Yeah.
We want to look at this happy go lucky shit. And it's great. I like it.
Yep.
But it just seems that the blues is not monolithic in one way.
Right.
You know, I mean, you listen to some of the Wolf stuff, it's scary.
It is scary.
You listen to somebody else join the Wolf stuff,
yep,
and it's not, the certain parts are taken out of it, the blues was invented as a way, as a cathartic means.
Right. Right.
To have a voice.
Exactly.
Jazz was engulfed into $2 million tour buses, $5 million private planes, $500 million private planes. That's fine. That is great. That shows how successful something is that these guys who didn't have a pot to piss in and a hand to hold and told don't let the sun go down on you.
Yep.
But they invented. Too bad if they couldn't have shed in those $500 million airplanes and things, you know. And so, for every great person like B.B. King who took up guys like me from the outhouse to the penthouse, B.B. King is like, what did he do? He used to lose guys like me and Robert Cray and Buddy Guy. He did stuff that made it possible for us to share in the rewards of it. He did for us what Muhammad Ali did for boxing.
Right.
Before, okay, and so, the Rolling Stones always gonna get their money. Always gonna get his money. Joe Bonamassa always gonna get his money.
Right.
You're gonna get all the, you know, and that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's our trend. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Jones is a big kid, so it encompasses everybody. Mm-hmm. And that is directly correlated to guys like Muddy Waters, accepting the Stones when they came over, mm-hmm. And guys like B.B. King, accepting people, guys like Muddy Waters, accepting Johnny Winters. That's my son, guys, Muddy accepting Bloomfield as a son. Bloomfield accepting me as his little brother.
Yeah, that's
he
awesome.
Accepting young little kids like Tyler Morris.
Yeah.
Is my friend. That's the big connection.
Yep.
That's it.
It's huge.
But it didn't come out. It didn't come out. The scary stuff. It didn't come out. God bless it, you know, and you know, just while I'm on it, just this thing. I take a lot of time. You know, I was a gopher, you know, with Robert Johnson's son, Robert Lockwood, I made a record that was nominated for a Grammy.
Right, sure.
So I had to ask Robert, what about the, you know, the crossroads, going to the crossroads, and you just think, Joe, why is it that we gotta go make a deal with the devil to learn how to take it down? And Robert just went to the woodshed and got down. He didn't make a deal with the devil. I listened to BB King and says, oh my God.
I know.
Now we gotta make a deal with the devil to take it down.
It's funny, you know, I know a reporter made up that story about Robert Johnson, and I know his family, what I understood, is not happy about that. They were never happy about that story. But I actually asked Johnny Winter, I said, you ever make a deal with the devil, Johnny? And I think I scared him. He said, no, I'm a good Christian, man. I'm a good Christian.
I mean, Johnny Winter's one of the nicest people you ever meet in your life.
Yeah.
Doesn't speak above whisper.
Yeah, I think I scared him. You know, if you make a blues record now about what's going on, 20 years from now, people are going to be scared to death.
Well, you know, it's like we listen to blues records, you know, from when it was topical political blues, 30s, 40s, you know, and you listen to songs like Natchez Inferno, Howlin' Wolf, or Flood in Texas, my friend Larry Davis wrote.
Right.
Flood in Texas. And you get a feeling,
mm-hmm.
Larry, when he's singing that song, that he was there for the flood, you know. And then you get a young guy coming along with Stevie Ray, and it's great that he caught into that, you know. But a lot of people listen for the Steelers guitar playing. They're not listening what the hell would it be like to be in a flood? And you can't get away. You know what? Oh, man, you know. And just to think that, you know, that Larry wrote that song, you know, or Howlin' Wolf did, you know, Natchez Berlin,
mm-hmm.
and just on and on and on and on and on and on. And that was the way for them to communicate, you know, that they were there for these, you know, life changing things, you know. And I think now, blues has sort of morphed into blues rock.
Right.
Where the onus is on sometimes, not all the time, two, three verses. I lost my baby the first verse. The second verse, I gotta find my baby. 18 guitar solos. The last verse, I find my baby.
That's funny. You're right. You are right about that. You know, there's so many great blues artists that never got the respect. And there was a lot of women, you know, Memphis Millie, man. I really got into her. You know Memphis Millie?
Memphis Minnie.
No, Minnie. Yeah, Memphis Minnie. Yeah. That's right. I got turned on, let's see, it was Maria Muldaur, did like a tribute to her on an album.
Mm-hmm.
And I really got into her. She was
incredible. Well, all you gotta do is go back to Sister Rosetta Stone.
Yep, that's right.
You Google her, man, and she's just wearing the guitar out. I look at her every other day on video, you know, or go back to Alberta Hunter or, you know, any of those women, Big Mama Thornton.
Yep.
Great
harmonica
or,
incredible.
You know, and there's a whole lot of sisters and young ladies now. Been singing the blues,
yep.
And some of them coming up singing the blues. They don't play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Singers in the vein of a Coco Taylor or Etta James, and who can really, you know, really let it out, you know. And so you get Tarika Copeland now. You got Tina Tedeschi.
Yep.
You know, you got some serious singing ladies who
Yeah, that's a big change, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
I think it's wonderful.
I do too.
Yep. Well, I need to talk to you about the new album, Blues Coming On. I gave it 5 stars, man. It's incredible. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
And you got some great guests on there. Yorma's on there. We just had Yorma on the show recently, another nice guy, really good guy. Let's see, my favorite tracks. I like, let's see, well, Blues Coming is one of my favorites, featuring Eric Gales and Dion. Dion's on that track also.
Yeah, Waddy's on that track too.
Yeah. And you also got Carla Cook does a couple of tracks on the album, which it's she's great. What a voice.
Oh, what a man, I'll tell you. You know, if it's one person I got turned on to the A&R man, you got to listen to her for maybe she could be strong with you. Wow. And I said, well, you know, I got another song for you to be on and get it off really good. And, man, I'll tell you, you know, I really love you. I say this because I have to say this about me, but for the life of me, I don't know why Carla Cook is a powerful name.
I agree.
I mean, she's right up there with Nat Nicole, Rest Her Soul, and Chaka Khan, and any of those people.
Sure.
You know, she ain't up there with Etta because Etta was, you know, before her generation, but, I mean, she's just so talented. I mean, it's really weird, you know, because I have so many friends that are the sons and daughters of very famous people.
Right.
You know, people that I know. And for all of them, it's like, sure, sir. For all of them, single. For all of them, it's a double-edged sword. You know what I mean? It really is. You know, I think for Carla, it could be a double-edged sword to Sam Cooke's father. You know, but as far as an artist, by any means, she stands on her own two legs, and boy, I mean, when I had to mix this record and edit it, there was nothing she did that I wanted to take out. I have to edit it, I gotta take something, you know, it's like a movie, you can't leave everything in.
Right,
you know? You gotta edit it, but I was like really hard editing
it
anything
is.
With her, because...
I understand.
Wow. You know.
You know, it's weird. You said that there's so many legendary artists out there that have kids that are incredible, but they don't get a break. You know, they really don't get a break, and I don't understand it one bit.
I can't figure it out. You know, and you can even go across genres with it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just thinking, Ricky Nelson's son.
Right.
They had a good record. But
yep.
They're good.
Yep.
They're in California, they're good. John Lennon's son, Julian Lennon.
Julian, yeah.
The ones that sort of broke the mold a little bit, I think, is Ricky Marvin.
Right.
But then again, Bob had so many kids, you could have an orchestra.
That's true.
It's like BB with 13 kids, or Solomon Burke with 12, Junior Wells with 19 kids.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, I listen to Julian Lennon, I'm quite concerned with you, John Lennon. And I'm gonna be the John Lennon fan in the world. And I listen to the other kid, Sean, and it's like, sort of like listening to Yoko Ono.
Yeah, I know.
And John Lennon a little bit, you know.
Yep.
But it sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds good now, you know. But I really feel for the scions of people that have made a name for themselves. It's just extremely hard. Now, if you write, that's different. Because like the first track on this song, the lyrics, I got the words that got me going. Gabriel Jagger, Mick Fern.
Really?
Gabriel wrote those.
I didn't know that.
The poems. And he sent me those because I've been knowing him, you know, two different ways anyway. And so when he wrote, you know, Feed the Poor, he wrote, you know, he sent me a poem, People Lying in the Gutter, No Father and No Mother.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone walks past. Because they're hypnotized by money's trance.
Yeah, that's a good
and
line.
I said, oh man, how can you like that? You know, and they start telling me, you know, and he sort of heard the B.B. King song,
right.
Help the Poor.
Yeah.
So, you know, Feed the Poor, and he sent me all these lyrics and stuff. I was like, Gabe, I'm going to write something to this. And I think, who's the first person to play guitar to this? And Yorma just dropped in my mind.
Yeah.
It took me about a year and a half to get, you know, when Yarmouth wasn't working.
Right.
And I wasn't working to get him to do it, but it worked out pretty good.
Well, like you always do on your albums, you know, you mix it up a little bit. You know, every song does not sound the same. It's all different. The stuff with Carla, you know, I'm a big R&B fan. I'm from D.C. and Baltimore originally, yeah. and I grew up with R&B. So when Carla sings, I listen, man.
Yeah, I mean, how can you not?
She's incredible.
It's got to be the right tune and the right platform. And you know what I like about her is that she doesn't overthink.
Exactly.
You know,
yep.
When you're overthinking all the melismas and melisma on every word and all the fake emotion, I just, you know, that sort of, for me as a musician, I always just say, why? You know, if you got a melody, just sing the melody, and then, you know, you have a part where you want to, you know, to ad lib a little bit here and there, that's fine. But, you know, when you listen to somebody that can do all the melismas and all the vocal runs, like a Aretha Franklin or somebody,
yep.
They didn't do it all the time,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, she knew how to sing a melody. She really did, you know? And that was, to me, you learn stuff like that in church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Carla comes out to church.
Yep.
You learn your lane. If you're singing with a group, you learn what your lane is and what you, okay, you're the first, you're second tenor, you're first tenor, you know, you bass, you alto, whatever. You know, you might have one person that can go all up and down the scale,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, but you really learn that you don't have, the harder you press, the less control you have over what you're doing.
It's got to come out natural. It's got to come out natural.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. That's what I'm looking for. You're exactly right.
You know who my favorite R&B singer was for long? Sarita Wright. Did you know Sarita?
Well, I know of her.
Yeah,
you know,
oh man, you know.
Wonder. I mean, we all know
she,
right?
Oh, I loved her. She's probably my favorite singer.
She also wrote the Billy Preston song with Billy Preston.
Yep.
You know, the Joe Cocker thing that brought his career back.
Exactly. They did Born Again together, hit her and Billy. Remember Born Again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the one that Joe Cocker did was a worldwide hit.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful song.
You Are So Beautiful to Me, that one?
You Are So Beautiful.
Yep.
And she wrote that with Billy out there.
Incredible. And she did, you know, the Jeff Beck song, We ended up in Lovers. Right, she did that before Jeff Beck, you know?
Yeah, she wrote some good stuff with Stevie, she was, you know, married to him, you know?
That's right. Yep. That's a shame, man. I'm so tired of people dying young. I hate that.
Yeah.
I really do.
It's one of those things where, you know, what you gonna do? You gotta play the hand you dealt, you know, not the one you want.
Back to the songs here. One song that really kicked my ass was, The Thing. The Thing featuring Jesse Johnson from The Time. The song, it really changed directions, didn't it? Because it ended up sounding like a Hendrix psychedelic jam. Man, that really shocked the hell out of me.
I can't help myself sometimes, you know. It's like, I wrote that song in 1984.
Uh-huh.
And I played it in all kind of different ways. But when I had one of these people I worked with, you know, who works with all those guys. He worked with Jesse Johnson and Howard Hewitt, and he works
right.
with all those cats, you know. And he said, Joe, you might want to talk to you. Jesse Johnson do it. And when the Jesse said, yeah, I just, you know, I said, oh, this is going to be something different.
Uh-huh.
So at the end, I put a tag on it. I tagged it with just a little bit of manic depression.
Right.
You know, where Jesse was just like, when Whitey heard that solo, look out the road. So all I did was play the feedback. I played the feedback.
Uh-huh.
There was no notes I could play. Jesse hadn't already played. is all the little funky guitar riffs that he's doing when I'm singing.
Oh, that's great.
That is, oh my goodness. When he did that, I got up and started dancing because I'm like, damn, I know I like him in the time. All those little funky ass sort of James Brown.
Oh,
that's it. But it ain't really James Brown, Jimmy Nolan stuff. That's just right. I'm like, hell yeah.
What a boy. Song.
And I got to have my girl on there who played with me for a few years. Uh-huh. And that's what he's doing. She plays the saxophone on there. A saxophone. So I was fortunate, you know.
You know, there was another song called The Thang by, was it Funk Inc.? Did you know that version of, it's a different song altogether, but they named it The Thang also.
Never heard of it.
Really? It's a group called Funk Inc. I think it's all, instrumental, if I remember. I can't remember.
Well, okay.
Yeah. It's funny how sometimes, you know, there's a lot of names. Same thing when you write a book, you know, same title over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. The book I have now is out. It's somebody else has the same title. It's a different, you know, mine are all interviews. He's actually got a story. So I don't feel bad.
Well, as long as you ain't thinking somebody's a band's name.
That's true. That happens too, man. That happens too. You know, stealing band names. There's sometimes you get the same name with five different bands. That does happen. So, you never know. A couple other tunes I liked. Bow-Legged Woman, Knock-Kneed Man. Oh, man.
Yep. My man, Bobby Rush. You know, Bobby Rush, that's
yep.
I was playing a lot in the 70s. We played it when it first came out. And I always loved it.
Tell you, man, if I could give this 6 stars, I would. That's how good the album is.
Well, thanks, man. I enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I bounce off people I respect. I think it's Waddy.
Mm-hmm.
Waddy enjoyed it for the most part. Dion enjoyed, you know, people part of it. And I think, you know, different tracks with people like John Austin, tracks with two of the people involved, to Carla and different friends of mine. And, you know, I'm sort of, I like to see what people think of stuff, you know. And
right.
People said, you know, that they, you know, they were so good. From I like to, you know, one of my friends, I always ask you, Joe, if you have fun, take a direction. And he said, if you don't think you have fun, I think you're probably going to work on it some more. And I had fun making this record.
Yeah. It's a fun record. It's a feel-good record. You know, it really is. And, you know, it's one of those albums you know, want to put on in your car and just keep driving. Lose yourself. Man, you've done so many great projects over the years. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you said, don't be afraid to add other cultures into your sound. That is so true, you know. Yeah, I mean, there's so much music, you know, in the world that you can add, and it's just...
Yeah, well, you know, it's the one thing that brings us together all the time.
Yep.
You know, it's like a remedy
mm-hmm.
for whatever ails you. And even, you know, if you go to a concert and you're sitting somewhere and you're grooving on the thing, you see somebody else on the groove, and you know, how you doing? You know, I went to a show and seen Francis McDermott. Next thing you know, you got a friend there that you met in Cincinnati.
That's right.
That's good music.
That's right.
And the optics of seeing everybody on stage, of men, women, black, white, Hispanic, whatever, all of us on stage together, you only see those optics in certain things.
Mm-hmm.
In sports, unfortunately in war.
Mm-hmm.
But the most positive is you see it in music.
Right.
You know, I mean, you see it in politics, but that's to divide us. It's
mm-hmm.
never to unite us. You know, and I think music is something that we all sort of lean on. You know, and that's the thing that I think right now that's really getting lost a little bit is that, you know, you can put monetary value on somebody not being able to go to work at the factory or go to work at the plant or go to work driving the bus. You can't put a monetary value on art. You know, it's very hard to do it, especially music and what it does for the psyche, what it does for the cathartic, what it does for bringing people together, what it does for all of that. You know, it's, I mean, you think about it. All through history, music has been there for any type of social change.
That's right. You know,
they got a famous American movie, The Grapes of Wrath.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us have seen it. And that story is basically about Woody Guthrie. When you get down to it, it's about Woody traveling with poor people. They call them bogeys unflatteringly, but they were just people that were down.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed how they had to really scuffle and fight for everything. And the hero, Tom Jones. You know, and then you fast forward that 40 years to Bruce Springsteen letting out a record about Tom Jones.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so music has always been there for any upheaval. And this is the first time that music is not being allowed to be there.
Yeah, exactly. You're 100% right. You are 100% right, man. You know, we were so lucky to grow up in a great time of music. You know, in the 60s, the 70s were good, you know, especially the 60s, because, you know, you put on Top 40 and you had anywhere from James Brown, Temptations, to Frank Sinatra, to, you know, I mean, it was a mixture all on Top 40. There's something there for everybody, you know. And somebody was saying that the protesters today, you know, the angry college white gut people that are destroying things, they're their music sucks, and that's why they're so angry.
Well, I don't know, I can't say that, you know, when you really depend on how deep you want to dive into it, I can't say that the young people today, regardless what kind of music they got, the reason that they're upset, for the most part, you got knuckleheads out there taking advantage of the situation.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
When you think about it, think of it. In 1962, I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My dad would send me back to Mississippi. He wouldn't go back. But he sent me to see relatives. 1962, the biggest thing was, when I went back there, nobody could vote that I knew.
Right.
None of my relatives, none of their friends.
Right.
And so, it sort of informed in me that when I was 14 in San Francisco, 15, I was marching at the federal building against things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was marching. And so, you fast forward now, what have these kids been left? A planet gets screwed up.
Yep.
44 million Americans out of work.
Yeah, it's hard.
You have
disease.
heading towards 120,000 Americans dead, and no one said, boom to a goose.
Yeah.
They haven't had one press conference that mentioned these people's names.
Right.
And so, you get less that.
Yeah.
And the ticker.
Yeah.
You get $1,200. You file for unemployment. So this generation, now they have skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
But you got enough of going to test up, but I guarantee you, most of those young people out there, they're tired of the sexism, the racism, the classism, and people 50 and 45 and 60, 70 like me, just put on the Bob Dylan record that we used to listen to. your time is rapidly aging.
Yeah, I know.
Get out of the way. So when someone's 15 years old sitting on their couch at home, that's 10 feet of those young people, all I got to do is two things to tell them.
Yeah.
Those young people were me.
Yeah.
And those young people are your nieces and your nephews and your daughters. Black, white, brown, green, and yellow.
Yep.
Get off their ass.
Yep.
And go out and complain about the makes you so riot at about. And then, while you're at it, now leave it alone after this. look at a picture. You can get them. Google Space of the world. Four and a half months ago. Look at the smog. And look at a picture of the world 2 months ago. And look at it less smog.
Right.
Well, what were we leaving those young people? What were we leaving them? And we're all guilty of it.
Yeah, that's
true. We have an opportunity to change that.
Yep.
Stick with it. This is Zillow's walk of cure. Take people who drive your license plate, have an even number. You can drive to work in a car pool on a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. On Tuesday and Thursday, you got to get rapid transit. Rapid transit will be made available. And when you have uneven numbers, you go on other days. That would cut the ozone layer in half.
Right.
Who on a 60-year-old butt or the 70-year-old butt or the 45 or 50-year-old butt wants to do that? I bet you most of these young people would, because they're going to inherit this milieu that we're leaving them.
Right.
So, I mean, when you look at it like that, throw the music out of the window. The music's never going to be like it was in the 60s.
I know.
Never going to be like that.
It never
has. But, you know, I think that what is trying to be accomplished is going to happen one way or another. If they're going to choose two things, it's a right or a wrong. Either we're going to do the right thing by nature, by trees, by the Amazon, by animals, by people, or we're going to do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And we know where the wrong thing is at. So we have an opportunity to do the right thing. And it's not going to be easy, but we can do it. You know, we can do it. We've done it before. We can do it. We've done it before.
You know what was so cool back in the 60s, 70s? You know, I mean, they expressed anger and change and everything through the music. And that reached us. You know what I mean? We understood and we listened to it and it helped us. You know, I mean, music, I would have never made it without music. You know, there's no way, man. You know, go ahead.
It raised people's awareness.
Yep.
You know,
it does.
It raised, you know, and I mean, you can take four, five, or six things, and I know that if I see them, you, I can say, John Lennon and Yoko Ono in a bedroom, what do you think of? What song do you think of?
Yep. Give Peace a Chance.
What song? Thank you. Okay.
Yep.
I can say, No Meat.
Yeah.
Think of. Same thing, Battery. Did you pick up nuclear disarmament?
Right.
With the movement made happen. Now you have a government, our government, wanting to bring back nuclear weapons. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
I don't know. It's government. Government's ridiculous.
Wait, man. If you're going to bring back nuclear weapons, I mean, I don't even know what to say no more.
I think people are still getting sick from the early testing, you know?
Yeah, well, but you're right. The music was sort of like the town crier.
It was a town crier, yep.
Yeah,
it was a pacifier, too, in a way, you know? It made you less mad to go out there and destroy things, you know? I mean, I remember, my dad had a business in D.C. since early 60s, and I was there. I grew up on F Street in D.C., man. I saw all the hippies marching and the yippies, and I even saw Nazis and all kinds of stuff, you know, because they got a permit and they marched. They marched right through the streets and everything, but most of it was peaceful, you know. I mean, I did get tear gas once at a Bob Hope, Billy Graham, Ann Margaret, big show for 4th of July, and the yippies caused trouble, and they tear gassed them, and it drifted. And you saw parents, kids, everybody running away, man, from the tear gas.
I don't know, man. I guess it just depends on where you sit, you know. I said that recently. The hippies and yippies were came from it. And I just got to be honest, man. I've never seen any hippies or yippies cause trouble unless they couldn't get something to eat once they got the munchies. But I did see a lot of them. You know, bikers and people beating people up.
Right.
I've never seen, you know, but then again, I was on the West Coast. You guys on the left coast. You were on the right coast, I guess. You know, so I don't know, but I do know that when
You had flower power.
We all have different experiences.
Yep.
We come up from, you know.
Yep.
And so I do believe that all these experiences inform the person that we are. But we also have, you know, that thing we're talking about, music.
Mm-hmm.
Music is allowing me and you to have this conversation.
That's right. That's
although
right.
We came up totally different. We came different things in different ways. I mean, so, you know, for me to say that the music stops people from being angry and sticking, the music raises people's awareness, mm-hmm. I think, and, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do when they feel like there's no way for them to express themselves.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, there's always a yin and yang, you know.
Yeah.
And I think we all know that if you want to really move forward, you can't do it killing people.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it hurting people.
Right.
You know, that's not a way to move forward. That's just the way, that's just the means that you, you know, you're trying to scare people, you
right.
know, and hurt people. I think that we can all move forward if we want to.
Well,
know,
there would be more peace if more people listened to Joe Louis Walker.
Well, I don't know. I hope, you know, I'll be 71 years old this year, and, you know, I do believe that more people want the same thing than don't want the same
thing. Right, right. I agree.
You know?
I agree.
You know, I really do believe that, and I believe it's people less than their brothers, if they can get together and extend that towards each other, it takes the fear
mm-hmm.
out of shit.
Yeah.
You got fear. When fear is the number one thing that motivates somebody, when you're scared of something, you start thinking irrational.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people think, oh man, I'm scared of that dog, or I'm scared of it. Well, dogs can tell when you're scared of.
Mm-hmm. I admire you for going back. You went to San Francisco State University. You got your degrees, music and English, and you performed with the Spiritual Corinthians Gospel Quartet. I'm going to tell you one concert I went to. I had front row seats for the Stones. And the opening act was the Mighty Clouds of Joy. And I'm going to tell you, Mighty Clouds of Joy blew away the Stones. That is the truth.
Well, yeah, but then again, if it wasn't for how cool that they are to bring the clouds out there, to, I guarantee you, an audience that probably 80% never heard of the Mighty Clouds.
Well, it's true. Yeah.
To show how fucking cool those guys are, you know, because they didn't have to do that.
But they were so genuine, you know? They were so genuine. Did you know that? Did you know the Mighty Clouds of Joy?
Yeah. I've been on programs with the Clouds.
Yeah.
When I was doing Gospel, the Clouds, the Soul Stillers, the Truth Fest, the Gospel Sessions, and Grant Fallon, the Clark Sisters.
Yep.
I mean, we all get programs together.
Gospel's great, man. It is. It's,
Yeah. And you better believe it. One thing you don't want to do is go on after a good, you know, roof raising gospel group.
No way.
But they're singing for a different reason.
Yeah.
You know, but it shows that, to me, you know, how cool the key to them was making them to bring the crowds mm-hmm. on there because, you know, I mean, just think about it. You know, who wants to, you know, have that type of competition? They won the competition, I guarantee you, they brought them on there because they like them.
Yeah, it's true.
Because they like them, and they want to bring them out there to try to get a bigger audience for them. And, you know, I can only go back to what Muddy had said, you know, Muddy and Beatty said, if it wasn't for my English voice, America wouldn't even know what the blues was.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
It's probably rock and roll neither.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for the Beatles playing. You know what's weird about the Beatles?
What's that?
You listen to them doing Roll Over Beethoven.
Uh-huh.
Different things like that. They did a lot of Chuck Berry songs.
Oh, yeah.
You ever hear them doing all the stuff you think?
I don't think so.
There you go.
I don't think so, no.
There you go, right there. There you go. That opinion right there, well, they thought the king of rock and roll was.
I think.
You ever hear him doing Little Richard song?
Little Richard, yeah, of course.
That opinion right there.
Long Tall
they
Sally.
With architecture of rock and roll.
Yep, they were the. I agree.
They didn't have it twisted. They had it straight out, man.
You know, if it wasn't for those guys, there would be no Beatles. You know what I mean? And R&B. You know, they did a lot of R&B stuff, too.
Yeah. And when they did it, you see what they did. Mm-hmm. Smokey Robinson. Mm-hmm. They'll get the things like this.
That's right.
But they did do Rockabilly. They did Buddy Holly.
Yep.
You know, because Buddy was cool, but Buddy Holly's best friend was Little Richard. A lot of people don't know that. But that was Buddy's best friend.
Yeah.
Little Richard. So you have learned that, but you know that just shows the music is a big pit, man.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get everybody together, that's what you get, you know. But I mean, I'm really glad you brought that thing about the crowd, you know, and the songs, because that just goes to show that when it came to the music
mm-hmm.
and the big pit, that they want the songs want to replay that set, mm-hmm. you know, to get set to say, oh,
right.
So African American music.
Yeah,
I've been knowing the Rolling Stones for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been in this house. I know Keith. I know them, and that's the way that they are. You know, and I tip my hat to them all the time because they really put their money where their mouth was.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, they so many justice in that arena. They never got in competition with the heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of Americans, they should have got in competition, you know. I mean, whenever Little Richard would let a record out, back to recover it, you know, just to make sure that it didn't get thrown or Fat Domino would make a record pass on, and Ricky Nelson would cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put, you know, the English guys came over and they sort of flipped that way around.
They did.
You know?
They did.
And I'm telling you, I knew what it was. I knew that he came. They made a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they were catching the hell here.
Yeah.
You know, blues is all this and that now, but I guarantee you, when I was in 1952, 1953, it wasn't very popular
mm-hmm.
amongst so many people as it is now. You know, and I'm not talking about white people, I'm talking about black people.
Right.
When I grew up,
right.
You know, I mean, I was a freak of nature playing blues 13 and 14. I really was. You know, because most of my friends were trying to play the latest song by, you know, the Temptations or the Supremes
right.
or Paul Revere and the Raiders or something. And I like all that stuff. I love it all.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it came to playing the blues for some reason, you know, the blues sort of, it hit me the same way it hit, you know, someone like Albert Lee when
right.
he put a third in the name.
Yeah.
You know?
You're talking about getting cigarettes for people. I did that for Alvin Lee. I was backstage with Alvin. And he had a hell of a concert. It was him and Eric Burdon at a small club, man. And Angie Dunbar was there, and a couple of guys from, I think, Boz Burrell was there. And I brought my guitar, and Alvin signed my guitar and played it. He didn't play it on stage. He played it backstage, and I went and got him cigarettes. So
yeah, that's Alvin or Alvin?
Alvin Lee, 10 years after Alvin
yeah,
Lee.
Yeah. I didn't know him, but he's a hell of an artist, man.
Yeah.
I mean, just a boy, can he play.
Yeah. He was fast. He was fast.
Yeah, I love his band.
Yeah. You know, I was lucky to cover, I covered John Mayall's 80th birthday here in Sarasota, man. And I hung out with John Mayall. And, you know, he was there setting up his own equipment, selling his own CDs. I mean, you know, to see a legend like that, you know, I don't think he got his ado, you know, like he should
have. Just think about it. Everybody that played on those early records with John, you know, that was the similar record of their career.
Right.
You know, so you listen to the Beano album, that's the seminal record of all those guys. Of not just the hip hop player, but you know, of Mick Fleetwood, of, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
The bass player. I mean, that's a seminal record, too.
Yeah.
You listen to Pink Peter Green.
Yeah.
That's a seminal record for him, you know, with Supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and The Stumble. You know, I mean, you really think about it, you know, without John Mayer, it's the whole a mile wide.
Yep.
You know, when it comes to not just English blues, but when he moved to California, you know, yeah, like Sugarcane Harris and yeah, Sid and Robertson for a while on guitar, yeah, a couple of guys that know. I mean, John knows, but the one thing John knows, he knows guitar players.
Mm-hmm.
So, he knows guitar players, man.
He's still got a good voice, too. He still sings good. He really does.
Yeah. You know, and John just is a special guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that is it. You know, Entourage, you know, none of that crap. John sells his own CD.
Mm-hmm.
He put his own little gear up. I mean, he just, you know, he's good man.
You know, the artist that opened up for him was decent, too. You know Larry McRae? Have you heard of him?
I know Larry very well.
Do you? He's an excellent guitar player. He really is.
Yeah, he was hanging on. He was singing too, and his brother.
Yep.
He's a good drummer.
Yep.
You know,
nice guy too.
Yeah, family of musicians. They're just excellent. Yep. You know.
Well, I know we're going to wrap this up soon. I just want to talk to you about Jimi Hendrix. What is your, you know, I talked to a lot of people that knew Jimmy. Lee Oscar was there at the jazz club in England for the night before he passed away. He was there with Eric Burdon. The war got up on stage and played with Jimi Hendrix. He had some good stories, but you're absolutely right, though. I don't know. He didn't seem like to be a happy guy. You know what I mean? I think the business was bothering him. He didn't get to do what he wanted to do, you know, and it showed. I think it showed, you know.
Yeah, I think you're a very connected person.
Yep.
You know, because I met you in '68 because I was living with Bloomfield,
mm-hmm.
But Michael had just quit the Carl Butterfield Bloomfield band, Carl Butterfield Blues band, and he said, you know, he told us the guys who were living at the house, because I'm bringing out some guys, man, that they don't know a lot of people out here. And he said, Joe, I got this drummer, and I want you and Johnny Kramer to take him to the Bridge Theater in South Florida for your practice. And I was 20 miles.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was about 17 and a half, 18, Buddy was about a year and a half older than me, I think. And Buddy always would talk about the guys in the industry, you know, talk about things. So one thing led to another. And when he came to town, Buddy threw a party for him, at least in Austin Mill Valley. And so, and he needed a place for his book, but he said, can we use your place for your camera? I think, yeah, I had a little spot. They had a place called the Heliport, you see. And Charles and Chaplin used to rehearse there. And they said, we all used to rehearse there.
Right.
And so, I let them use that spot, but I went to the party, and I came a couple other times, and he was just really thoughtful, and, just, God never talked about the winter. You know, I mean, never seen anybody, you know, really nice cat. And I'll tell you, I mean, you hit it on the nail. That's the whole thing. You know, to me, the best record Jimmy Hendrix made that we got to hear was called Band of Gypsies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. For two reasons. That he got to play with the people that he wanted to play
right.
with. At that particular time.
Right.
And 30 Miles gave him a pocket. The plan gave him a groove and took some of the singing weight off of him, and it just shows, you know, and everybody knows the famous story about before that show, Abraham went to Jimmy and said, you know, you're sort of a character of yourself, you jump around, you like the guitar with yourself. That's why I just say, when you see the film, the video of Jimmy, he stands in one place the whole show.
Yeah.
He doesn't play behind his back. He doesn't do anything. And the story goes at the end of the show, Bill Graham comes over and says, hey man, forgive me, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. Well, obviously you don't, you know. But with Jimmy, I think you're right, you know. We have to come to be pretty good friends with Jimmy, but Jimmy Cox, you know, we're probably going to do some recording here. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to do some things for this record, but it didn't work out.
Yeah.
But, and Billy, Billy doesn't talk a lot about that, but, you know, I knew Buddy very well, Miles, and some of the guys, and you know, the general knowledge was that that was going to be his last gig, the Isle of Wight, his last gig with the so-called Experience, because the bass player had already quit. And it's kind of a knowledge of the bass player sort of didn't get along with Jimmy that much, and there was some weird shit that was pretty harsh.
Mm-hmm.
And the situations, you know, where Jimmy was so frustrated, where he had destroyed a hotel room, I think it was in Sweden. You know, so a lot of his partners really wanted him to just come home to America.
Right, right.
You know, come on back home, bro. You know, just to be quite honest.
Yeah.
Come on back home. You don't have to be Jimmy Hendrix to start around though.
Right.
You just another buck.
Yeah.
You know, we got you back, so to speak, and he never got a chance to do that. And unfortunately, you know, that's the legacy that we'll never know, because you can see it at that Isle of Wight concert where him and he's just screaming at the drummer.
Yeah.
You know. You know, just screaming at him. You can Google it right now.
Mm.
You know, I mean, he's just so unhappy, you know, with what he started off to do and what happened. And I just agree with it. There's other people that can talk about it way better than me. Billy Cox being one of them, but Billy's not going to talk about it.
Right.
But, the word was among us that Jimmy was able to keep $2.50 in his pocket. You know how much was in the bank when they went to wrap up his accounts in the bank?
I'm afraid to ask.
£2.50.
Really?
So he takes $500,000, but by the time he go to the bank, he's got £2.50.
Oh my.
That ought to tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah.
Right there.
I don't think Chaz Chandler was a good match for him. What do you think?
I think, you know, the timing's everything, and I think the timing right. that, you know, as a little anybody, the timing that Jimmy went to England, and, you know, I mean, it was the perfect timing, because people who helped him in his career, who helped him because they liked him as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
The Paul McCartney getting him on the Monterey Pop Festival.
Right.
You know, they said, well, the Beatles and Paul saying, no, take Jimi Hendrix. You know, well, how you gonna not take somebody when the Beatles is there taking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's like you saying the Mighty Clouds of Joy. And 80% of your audience, including you, probably didn't know who the hell the Mighty Clouds was. But when they got through, you did, right?
Yeah.
Right? So, when he came home to America, nobody knows who he was that much.
Mm-hmm.
But when he got through, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it's sort of like, and you know, just think, you know, you're a guy like that. You go to England, you get to meet people that you've only seen records of, and some of them are cool, some of them are lukewarm towards you. But the biggest group in the world, one of the guys, is about to come see you and says, hey, man. That guy needs to give him a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Give him a break, man.
Yep.
And you make the most of that break. And then you go on a year or 2 years, you're the number one thing in the world. And then you got guys in the group that, I love this one. Guy comes to audition for the Jimmy Hendrix Experience and thinks he's going to be the guitar player. How in the hell, what alternative universe are you living in?
Imagine going to that concert with Jimmy with the Monkees.
Oh,
man.
I got some great pictures of Jimmy, man. You know, I got
really?
Some great pictures of nobody has.
Yeah, save those for the book, man.
Yeah, I got one of a girl at that show jumping up and whistling in Jimmy's ear.
Uh-huh. Kidding me.
Can you play some
songs
like, you know, like Stepping Stone by the Monkees?
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Jeez. Ambassador Jimmy was for our generation. Mm-hmm. He didn't get pissed.
Yeah.
He never got pissed off. He put all of his emotions into his music, you know.
Yeah.
And boy, I'll tell you, it was a lot of emotion. There's a lot going on there.
He was just a cool, he was a cool dude all along. You know, he's just,
yeah, he was, yeah, just all the way around, man.
Yeah.
You know, just can't say enough about him. I always like to say he was anything that was right.
Right. Exactly.
Know, my generation, the hippie
yep.
generation,
yep.
and just the inventiveness, you know, you were talking about when we were coming up, how, you know, when we were coming up, people would do records. And every record would be different.
Yeah.
But not only that, you know, they were finding out how to ways to work in a studio. And I always said that outside of John Lennon and the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix knew how to use the studio as another instrument.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
definitely.
Backwards guitar solo,
yeah.
all kinds of things that you, you know, patterns from left to right, just the drum break and action solos as well. You go from left to right, you know, I mean, all that stuff is just all brand new. And we were taking on a trip.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it was such a great trip, man, because we were all, it was just a great time.
You didn't have to take acid with Jimi Hendrix. It was natural.
You didn't have to with the Beatles either.
Yeah, that's true.
You
know, that's true. George Martin with his classical training, you know, going, what? Yeah.
But, you know, they're losing me, God bless it. You know, you gotta have someone, you know, that, you know, they really have a little bit of, you know, it's a job. It's a good job, but it's a job.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got so much time to do things, and you got, you know, the kiss of death. Sometimes when guys just do records and it takes forever to do. And to me, it's just like somebody in a room wanking off.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
you know what? After two or three times, you ain't doing it no better. You're just doing it more.
Right.
Now, you know, you can fine tune it to fine tune that, but just to get things perfect and stuff like that, it just takes the humanity out of some things, I think.
Exactly. I got the final question for you, but I just want to mention, I'm friends with, Bobby Womack's nephew. Dickie Womack is his name. He's got a bunch of albums out. He's a guitar player and he plays a mean electric guitar. And he's kind of like you. He does an R&B, he does some soul, he does a rock, you know, a little bit of everything. If you ever want to, you know, talk to him or whatever, let me know and I'll hook you guys up. He's a pretty cool guy. Where's he at?
Yeah.
I don't know where Binky's at. I forgot where he's at. But he always sends me his new stuff, and he's on YouTube. He's got some great stories about, you know, people coming to his house too. You know, when he was young and everything. But he's a good guitar player. Good guitar player.
Who's his father? Is his Bobby's nephew? Is his father?
I'm not sure whose dad is, but all I know is, his uncle's Bobby Womack. But, yeah, he's another guy. He's not getting any recognition, you know, and he's, you know, I'm like you. I like to help these guys out, you know, as much as I can.
Yeah, I feel you, man. Well, I'm going to,
B-I-N-K-Y. It's kind of funny. He calls himself Binky Womack. Because he had a Binky when he was little, you know, for a long time. It's kind of funny.
Binky?
Yeah, Binky. B-I-N-K-Y.
Okay, I'm gonna look him up, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Look him up, and if you want any interest, I could give you his email, and you know, he's a Facebook friend. A nice guy, really good guy.
Okay, I can look for him on Facebook, too.
Okay.
I'm like you, I'm trying to work with newer people, and
right.
You know, I knew Bobby a little bit.
Yep.
You know, that's way cool, man. Thank you.
Yeah, I like Bobby Womack, too. He's a great artist as well. All right, Joe, here's your final question. Here's a question I ask everybody, and I get some really interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Probably Elmore James.
Elmore James, that's a good answer. Yeah.
Just a voice from hell.
Oh yeah, he was incredible. Have you ever heard Eric Burdon's song "No More Elmore"? Have you ever heard that?
No.
Yeah. No more Elmore James. Really good song. Eric Burdon. Joe, man, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for giving me so much time. I appreciate it. The album is incredible. 5 stars, 6 if I could do it, if they let me do it. I hope to see you in concert, man, as soon as all this crap is gone, you know?
Yeah, as soon as they rack them back and let us have a little bit of fun. But I'm going to keep your number here. I might write this book, and I've been offered a couple of people,
sure.
Blah blah blah. But I'm just gonna keep the numbers, so I'll keep that bee in my bonnet, so to speak.
Well, if you send John Lapton, if you send him your address, I'll send you my book I'll just send it to you.
Cool.
Okay. It's a great book. You'll like it. It's got everybody in there. The hardcover looks like the Holy Bible of rock and roll. It looks really cool.
All right. Well, great, man. I will definitely do that.
Okay, man. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, man. And, when this is all over, try to come to Florida if you can.
Oh, yeah. I'll be there.
All right. That'll be awesome.
Okay, thanks.
All right. God bless you, brother. Take care, man.
You too. Same to you. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, Joe. Take care. Bye. Purchase the new album by Joe Louis Walker entitled Blues Coming On, Soulful Blues Phenomenon and Blues Hall of Famer inductee Joe Louis Walker is joined by a host of talented friends and peers on the superb studio album. Features guest performances by fellow blues icons Keb Moe, Eric Gales, Albert Lee, plus Detroit soul singer Mitch Ryder, harmonica virtuoso Lee Oscar, Hatuna Jorma Kokkonen, punk rock vocalist Charlie Harper, legendary session player Waddy Wachtel, and many others. This album explodes with the passionate playing and soulful melodies that have made Walker a favorite among true blues aficionados, including the Rolling Stones. It's available now at Amazon.com. For more information about Joe Louis Walker, visit his website at www.joelouiswalker.com. He's also on Facebook, www.facebook.com/Joe Louis Walker. Very special thanks to John Lapton Enterprises for arranging this interview with Joe Louis Walker, and of course the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And, of course, my new book is finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles Series 1. Chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us all free. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook at bookbaby.com, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends the world will ever know. God bless you all. Have a great week. Stay safe and healthy. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, everybody. for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans, we shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on PBS Radio, Station 1.